It's one thing to listen to doom and gloom about food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation. It's quite another thing to hear practical, immediately actionable advice from experts who can help you reduce the fear, anxiety, and burden of these problems.
Tune in now to the Surviving Hard Times podcast from the Finding Genius Foundation with Richard Jacobs. Before we begin, a note from our sponsor. I'm Richard Jacobs, Executive Director of the nonprofit Finding Genius Foundation and host of the Finding Genius podcast. In late 2016, I was rear-ended at 65 miles an hour by a truck on the highway, which sent me off-road into a ditch. The impact of the collision gave me a concussion and other injuries. At the hospital, a CT scan showed that I had thyroid nodules, which turned out to be cancer. It was then, when I had a biopsy in my neck, that I realized even if I was a millionaire, I wouldn't want a second or a third biopsy due to the pain and the invasiveness of it. And appointments at that time for thyroid experts were 3 to 6 months out, and I was worried about dying now, even if that was irrational. So because of this, I've decided to raise money to conduct a literature review on steroids, on the causes of anxiety and depression, a condition that affects well over 50 million people in the United States and hundreds of millions worldwide. Our goal is to create a codex, a guide, that reveals all possible treatments for anxiety and depression for people that live with the condition, or for loved ones that have it, as my wife and my son do. To find out more about our fundraiser, visit findinggeniusfoundation.org and click on Current Initiatives. And now, to our guest. Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Surviving Hard Times podcast, sponsored by the Finding Genius Foundation.
I have Blaine Hitzfield. He's the CEO of distribution of Seven Sons Farms. Their website is sevensons.net. So we're going to talk about their work and their farm and what's unique about them. Blaine, thanks for coming.
Hey, excited to get on and chat.
If you would, tell me about the history of Seven Sons. How did it come to be? And are you one of the sons? So which one are you?
Yes, I am one of the Seven Sons. I'm number two in line. So as you mentioned there, I handle all things marketing, distribution, and business development here at the farm. Love what I do. My wife and I have been married for 16 years, have 6 children. We homeschool the kids and raise them here on the family farm. So, but yeah, I can give you a little bit of background about our farm. So this is started by my parents in the late 80s. When they first got married, my dad purchased his first initial 20 acres from an existing farmer. So kind of moved into the business that farmer had going on at that time. And at that time, it was strictly a conventional farming operation. The working farm that he purchased had a farrow to finish hog operation on it. So very conventional, you know, known as a CAFO today. I don't think they called them CAFOs back in the 80s, as far as I know, but that's what it was. My dad also had about 1,000 acres of row crop corn and soybeans that they farmed.
1,000 acres? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was not a land that he owned. He leased it. These were lease contracts that came from the farmer that he purchased the 20 acres from initially, kind of that main farmstead. But that's when it started, strictly conventional. My dad will tell you, I mean, he started off farming exactly how, you know, Purdue Ag School would have taught him to farm. He didn't know anything different. But my parents kind of got a rude awakening in the late 90s, which I'm happy to share kind of the transition of what got us thinking different than conventional agriculture. But
one quick thing, as you mentioned, a CAFO, that's what, a concentrated area feeding?
Concentrated animal feeding system. So
okay. So for listeners, they picture like a whole bunch of chickens stuffed in shoulder to shoulder, or cows stuffed in, or,
yes.
Or what should they picture?
A cattle feedlot, or yeah, a large barn. You know, all the CAFO chicken barns have a minimum of 20 to 100,000 birds in a single barn. Mm-hmm. Most of them, you know, most of those barns still don't have any outdoor access. Most eggs, you know, when you talk about chickens in a CAFO, most of the eggs that are produced are still from caged hens that are, you know, in cages, not even access to a barn floor. So in our case, we were raising hogs. So we would have, you know, mama pigs, you know, that would get stuffed into a crate where they can't turn around. All they can do is stand up and sit down. And that's where they had their, you know, their litters. And then, you know, the offspring of those, you know, those mama pigs would then get raised in concrete floor barns with manure pits below them. You know, it was a deal where you know, if you lost power to these buildings, these CAFO buildings, if you lost power and you lost the ability to recirculate the air for more than 30 minutes, you would have animals suffocating. That's how toxic and unideal the environment and unforgiving the environment is in a CAFO system for hogs, for example. So,
oh man,
yeah.
Quick question: What did your parents? You know, I don't know if you've ever asked them, but how did they feel about what they were doing back then versus what they're doing now?
Well, I mean, back then they didn't know any different. They felt really proud of what they were doing, honestly, and that's kind of the mindset in general in agriculture, especially industrial agriculture. It's very difficult to think a different way. Matter of fact, but my dad would probably tell you that he would have been pretty offended if somebody, ever told him, he shouldn't be using chemicals, for example, in the row crops, or that, maybe a CAFO hog operation isn't the best thing for the welfare of a hog and the best thing for the health of the consumer. He probably really would have took offense to that. And that's just where we were at that point. It's kind of have to really change your beliefs to be open to new ideas. And that's definitely what happened for my parents.
Okay. Well, what happened then? How did the transition begin? Was there an event or is it slowly over time?
Yeah, the transition ultimately was slower over time, but the thinking changed pretty quickly. Actually, when my mom was actually diagnosed with a very severe autoimmune condition, arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, it was very severe. The doctors told her that at the rate in which the autoimmune disease was progressing, she could end up in a wheelchair. At that time, there was only three of us brothers, and doctors told her she wouldn't be able to have any more kids. And that within 5 years, she could end up being in a wheelchair. Because at this point, it was hard for her to even get out of bed to go to the bathroom. My dad would carry her to the bathroom. That was how bad
the
condition was. So it was... That's something that kind of rocks your world and makes you just, rethink everything. And so what had happened is my dad met a soil agronomist. His name is Ray Smith. He's from Indiana. And just in passing, my dad was mentioning my mom's health struggles. And Ray Smith was a very, very holistically minded soil agronomist. He knew so much about soil health, plant health, human health. Was really the first person my dad had ever met that really had such a holistic understanding of how agriculture, food production also affects, the health of people. And this guy was very smart. He actually studied under one of Albert Einstein's assistants. So it had a lot of generational knowledge and genius passed down to him. But long story short, he was able to offer my mom nutrition and advice, and she had a dramatic turnaround in her health just by following some very simple nutritional protocols that the soil agronomist suggested. And it had to do with balancing her pH, for one thing, was a real turnaround for her, and really adjusting her diet and some lifestyle changes. And my parents were so amazed at the turnaround that her health took, that they really began to listen to the soil agronomist. And his principles that he taught is that all life begins in the soil, and it translates all the way to human life and human health. And the basis of industrial agriculture is it's propped up on using synthetic chemicals that create a chemical reaction in the soil to produce calories, but ultimately it's empty calories, because the real way to produce food is you want a biological reaction happening in the soil, a biological system that's making nutrients available to plants through the soil and through the natural, natural mineral cycles, natural systems that are taking place in the soil. You need that life in the soil to truly release nutrients to plants and that animals consume, and that ultimately, if we're consuming those plants or consuming animals. My parents really became convinced that, hey, as farmers, we have a big role to play in the health of society, and we can't ignore this any longer. We saw the difference that health and nutrition made for my mom. And so that's when they were really sold out on a vision and a mission to ultimately one thing: improve the health of our soil and raise healthier food for our own family and for friends and neighbors. And we really didn't have a vision for growing a brand. Actually, we didn't. There was no vision for growing a brand or a food company. it was just to farm better and to offer products to friends and neighbors.
Okay. So your parents started understanding and improving their own health. And then what about the farm? When did that thinking change alongside of their own personal health thinking?
Yeah. So it was, you know, there was about a year or two where they were just, you know, studying and learning. But by 1996 is when my parents decided to sell all of the confinement hogs that were on the farm, which was the main source of cash flow. It was the main business, that confinement hog business. We were producing for Tyson Foods at the time. And that was a really, really big decision. It's a tough decision. There's a reason that CAFO operations and industrial farming operations don't make quick transitions, because so much of the infrastructure involved with raising animals in a CAFO system, infrastructure that's very expensive, it's 20 to 30 year long-term investments, paybacks, and you can't liquidate it. You can't repurpose it. You know, you're talking about automated feeding systems, automated watering systems, you know, automated manure systems, you know, so it's really tough to make a transition. But they decided to do that, basically close the doors to that infrastructure, and it sat empty. And we experienced some pretty tough economical times for about the next 10 years as we transitioned to regenerative practices. So ultimately, when we sold the hogs, we started converting our corn and soybean monocrop land into perennial pastures. So going back to a pasture-based system, we started reinvesting in building fencing systems for pasturing our animals. And we reinvested in actually getting cattle on the farm. You know, all this while our cash flow from the conventional business had been shut off. So ultimately, economically, we went backwards for a time there. So it was a real struggle. But by 2000, we actually started the Seven Sons business and brand at that time.
Well, quick question. So I don't know much about pastures. I know that, you know, it's places where cattle will hang out and eat the grass, et cetera. Instead of keeping them concentrated, what do you have to do in order to have them roaming? Do they have to alternate between, you know, five or six different pastures, like one day a week? Or,
yeah,
you know, what was the method that you had to use?
Yeah. I mean, back then, you just kind of called it rotational grazing. You know, now we call it more adaptive grazing, but it's the same principle. It's the principle that animals should never stay in a single place, you know, more than a couple of days. That's an ecological principle that when you look at nature, animals never stay in a single place. You know, they're never confined to an area for more than a couple of days. So, you know, just mimicking nature's patterns of grazing animals. If you look at the bison that would have grazed the prairies hundreds of years ago, you know, they're always, you know, grazing the land and then moving on to the next spot, so that the land they just grazed can rest and recover for the animals to come back, you know, maybe 90 days later. In our case, we have about a 60 to 90 day rotation for all of our pastures. So all of our cattle are moved either every day or every 2 days to a fresh pasture spot. So we're using a lot of portable electric fencing. Every year, Rich, we actually build about 100 miles on our 500 acre farm of portable electric fencing. We're building it, taking it down. It's not a big setup. They're just single strand little paddock fences, but it's electrified and it's enough to keep the animals in a little space, and we move them on. And the idea is that the animals are, you know, kind of pruning the landscape. And when the animals move off of a freshly grazed spot, those plants get a chance to recover and rebuild their root systems. Because when animals come along and graze a plant, what happens is whatever amount of the plant that the animal grazes on the top of the soil, you get about the same amount in what's called a root slough, where those roots will die off and feed the soil biology in the soil. So that's what you want to happen. You want to be feeding that soil biology through grazing the plants to release some of the root energy, and then give the plant time to recover its roots and grow new roots. And so it's a cycle of basically sequestering carbon back into the soil and feeding all the soil life, so that the soil is actually improving over time. And it's done through just the intentional rotational grazing of livestock, you know, ruminant animals. So, and we have, you know, today we have about 200 head of cattle that graze our farm each year. We've got close to 1,000 lambs on our farm. And then we have about 14,000 laying hens for eggs that also rotate throughout the pastures during the growing season. So it's pretty neat sight to see. So
what were some of the tips or tricks or difficulties you had with the different animals? Like, is there any that come to mind, one that was particularly difficult and why in migrating them to this new system?
Well, the tricky part was with the cattle genetics was tricky to find the right genetics that would finish well on grass. I mean, most of the cattle genetics that are bred in the U.S. Are bred to perform well in a feedlot scenario. And the big difference is cattle genetics have been bred to basically to not have much of a rumen, much of a stomach. And that's the tool on a grazing animal that, you know, is able to hold a biomass, grazed grass, and they, you know, that four-chambered ruminant stomach converts that pasture, that roughage, you know, into meat. And if you don't have much of a rumen capacity on an animal, they can't convert that forage well. And ultimately, an animal in a feedlot doesn't need much of a stomach. They're just standing in front of a feeder eating, you know, high starch, high energy grain all day. Ultimately, the breeders have bred out those components like a large stomach, a wide girth, all those characteristics of a traditional beef animal have been bred out of these animals. And so it took us a while to rebuild our genetics and to find breeders that were breeding animals that would perform well on grass. Because if you don't have the right genetics, you end up producing a subpar, poor quality beef product, which a lot of people that maybe tried eating grass-fed beef, you know, 10, 20 years ago, they experienced a poor quality eating experience. It's not very marbled. It can be tough and leathery. And that's just because of the poor genetics. So that was a real learning curve for us, was getting the right genetics. The next learning curve was really just...
Quick question about that. So was there no appreciable cattle that were kept, you know, unbred and unmodified from many years before? Were they all transitioned over? Where there was so many transition over that you just couldn't find economically the ones you needed?
Yeah, it was difficult. Luckily, there was still some heritage breeds, you know, that were out there that certain breeders were beginning to, you know, were trying to make available to grass finishers like us. And so we did end up finding some. Today we use a lot of Murray Gray genetics. That's a old English breed that really hasn't been tampered with. There's two strains of Murray Gray. One strain has been tampered with quite a bit, and there's a heritage strain or line that hasn't been. And so we focused on some Murray Gray genetics. We also have found there are some Angus breeds, lines that have been preserved. So typically we stick to what's considered old English breeds, heritage breeds that have done a lot better on grass. And it's typically, when you look at the animal, it's a smaller animal. They're closer to the ground. They're wider, they're thicker. Where a feedlot animal is what they call pencil gutted. It's long, it's narrow, tall legs. You know, that's what most of the genetics here in the U.S. is for cattle. And they're just not efficient on grass at all.
Well, if someone were to look at a picture of two different cows side by side, you know, the grazers versus the feedlot ones, like how dramatic is the difference visually?
I mean, you're going to see, the biggest thing you're going to see is the distance between the bottom of the stomach and the ground. A feedlot animal is just going to stand so much taller if you're looking at the side of the animal. You're also going to see on the feedlot animal, you know, the difference in, like, just looking at the legs of the animal. These are some of the characteristics we look at. You want a finer boned animal. So when you're looking at the side, look at the legs. It needs to be a finer bone. It's kind of a smaller leg, shorter to the ground. And then when you're looking face on at the animals, you definitely want a thicker animal. So and a much wider gut. So like where the stomach begins to come out, like you're looking down the long end of an animal, you want to see a protruding stomach on each side. That means there's rumen capacity. There's capacity to go forage and graze and convert that into energy. And you want to see a wide muzzle. So like on a feedlot animal, they haven't been bred to have a wide mouth or a wide muzzle, but that's, you know, that's the harvesting machine that these animals have when they're out there grazing. They need to have a wide muzzle. So those are just characteristics we look for and the right genetics. Another one is disposition. You need to have a gentle, calmer animal, a high strung, stressed out animal is never going to do well on grass in a grazing system.
Okay. And then what were some of the difficulties you had, let's say, with the hogs, or what was the next most difficult and why?
Yeah, I would say next was kind of the laying hens, figuring out how to raise hens outdoor in a rotational system was difficult. I mean, one of the challenges was just predation, dealing with ground predation or aerial predators, eagles, hawks. You could come out one morning and, notice there's 30 or 40, hens that are gone. Predators got them overnight. We have coyotes and raccoons and minks in our area. And so predation was pretty difficult. Today, we've got it a lot more refined. So we have electric netting that we actually put around each one of our flocks of hens. So we have hens in flocks of about anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 hens in a single flock. So we'll surround those flocks with electric netting. And that electric netting has to be moved every day. But that keeps the ground predators, at bay. And then we also have Great Pyrenees guard dogs that will patrol the areas that are fenced in. And that really helps as well. And that seems to really help with aerial predation, because when we have the hens in a fenced in netted area, their flock density, they're close enough together that it tends to intimidate aerial predators from wanting to swoop in. An aerial predator wants to swoop in and grab a hen that's, that's ventured far off from the main group, where you just don't have that if you're surrounding the birds with netting. But the hard part of that is you have to move the netting every day. But when we're combining 3,000 to 6,000 hens in a single flock, it may take a half hour to move the netting each day, but that's not bad when you're considering you're moving 3,000 to 6,000 laying hens. So
how do that many hens get along? I mean, how many, are there any roosters amidst them?
No,
does a rooster care for X number of hens?
Nope, we don't need roosters because we're not harvesting any fertilized eggs. We're not doing any of our own hatching, so no roosters in our case needed. The hens do well together. The smaller the flock, the better. That's why we'll run a lot of 3,000 bird flocks instead of 6,000 bird flocks. Just the community dynamics, the competition, the pecking order is reduced. Smaller flocks, but one key is that we always keep the same age hens in the same flock. That really reduces the pecking order and really reduces stress and some of the stressful community dynamics you would get if you had multiple ages in a single group. So,
the older hens dominate, and then do they starve out the younger hens, or what happens?
Yeah, they establish a pecking order, and it's very hard to notice if you're just walking out among the hens. But they have their own pecking order. They'll guard the feeders. They'll guard the watering spots. They'll guard the best roosting spots, and they'll peck on each other. I mean, it's literally a pecking order where if a certain hen gets too close and they're lower on the pecking order, they'll get pecked. I don't think science quite understands the dynamics of that animal behavior and what that pecking order is all about. But we just know smaller flock sizes does help in keeping the same age hens together. So another challenge, Rich, with the laying hens is that your main economical factor of whether or not a hen business is profitable on a farm is the lay rate. So how many eggs can you get from a hen each year? So the industrial CAFO barns will get easily 90% lay rates throughout the year. So that means out of the full year, one hen will lay an egg 90% of those days. So in pasture-based models, when I talk to other farms, and this was a struggle for us, a lot of other farms struggle and hover around the 50 to 60% lay rate. And that just makes it really, really hard to be economical. And there's just greater factors of out in the pasture, it's less of a controlled environment. Your lighting fluctuates. The environment is fluctuating as you move the birds. They're not in a controlled, heated or cooled environment. So whatever the summer temperatures are doing, whatever the winter temperatures are doing, the hens are experiencing those climatic changes. And it's just more difficult to keep the hens, laying eggs well. So we've really refined our model, and we have very, very intentional hoop buildings that each of the hens have access to every day to go in to lay their eggs, to get feed and water. We're very intentional about our, we actually have a solar lighting system in all of our chicken hoop buildings that the chickens go into at night. So we have controlled lighting systems for them out there on pasture. And so we're able to keep our lay rates up to 75 to 85% throughout the year. And that's that difference of, say, 80% versus 60%. That's most of your profit in a laying hen business. So that was a challenge to figure out how to get that lay rate up. So
what did the farm look like, let's say, in the beginning? And what does it look like today? Like, what are some of the major changes you made? I know it's a broad question, but, what do you know now that you've been doing this for X number of years you didn't know in the beginning?
Well, yeah, I'm trying to think of some of the bigger mistakes that we made. I know that when we first got started, we actually had a lot of different animal classes on the farm. You know, we were raising, we had brood cows and we had a cow-calf operation. So that means we had mama cows and bulls, and we were raising the calves and taking them through the feeder phase is what it's called. It's kind of the young phase of a cow, taking them all the way through finish to where they're market ready or ready for harvest. So there's just a lot to manage when you're doing all your animal classes on your farm. When we did our pastured hogs, we had our own sows and boars, and we were raising our own litters. And same thing with laying hens. We were getting our own baby chicks in as day-old chicks, raising the chicks. And we also had meat birds on the farm. So we were raising meat birds. We were raising turkeys. We had goats at one time. And so ultimately, if you would have visited us maybe 10 years ago, you would have saw a lot going on, a lot of different livestock classes and species. And what we've done in the last, I would say in the last 5 to 6 years, we've really focused on, okay, what can we do well as a farm? What is our climate and our soil, our landscape? What is it best set up for? And so we've really gotten a little bit more focused. For example, we don't raise our own calves anymore on our farm. We buy calves from several trusted producers that we have connections with. And we just finish the animals on grass on our farm. And we've decided to do that because we're in an area where the land is very expensive. It's very fertile. The grasses that we grow here are very high energy, and they're best for that finishing phase of a grass-fed animal. So that's the phase we focus on. Same thing with the laying hens. We don't raise our own chicks anymore. We buy in what's called a started pullet at 16 weeks old. They're basically ready to lay eggs at that time. So we've had to get a little more focused because it's easy to get overwhelmed. We were very single-minded back as a conventional farm, you know, back 80s through the 90s. We didn't hardly have any diversity. Well, when we changed our philosophies, you could say that we ended up overdoing it with way too many animal classes and way too much to manage. Nature, the systems below the soil and the ecosystem is complex, and complex systems can manage themselves. But when you start layering, several different businesses and animal classes on your farm, and you're trying to run profitable businesses, businesses are super complicated, and there's always problems. There's always things to manage about them. So we have had to reduce the number of livestock classes. And that's something I see, if there's any other farms listening to this that are diversifying and they're stacking their enterprises and their livestock classes, you have to be careful not to overwhelm yourself. And before you know it, you've got a lot of different things going on the farm and you're not really doing any of them very well.
No, that's true. That makes sense. What do you guys feel like you're best at? Maybe in the, I don't know about in the world, but what do you feel like you're really, really good at in your farm?
Well, we consider ourselves a grass farm. And so we feel like what we've done the best at is improving our soil. That's ultimately our end goal. That's how we measure whether we feel like we're progressing as a farm or we're growing as a farm. And we do that using different tools. The tools that we like the best are finishing, cattle on grass, using those animals as a natural pruning mechanism for the landscape. We love having the laying hens on the farm. Just having the laying hens as a part of our livestock rotation, those hens apply about 4,000 pounds of organic chicken manure to every acre of every single year. So it's such a benefit. And we feel like we've really figured that out and have done that well. Something new on the farm this year is actually the 1,000 lambs. That's kind of new for us. So I wouldn't say we're the best.
1,000 lambs?
Yes. Jeez. Yes. I wouldn't say we're the best at that yet. We're learning kind of on a steep learning curve with the.
Is there such a thing as a thousand, like a herd of lambs? I mean, that's a question I want to ask you. What animal behavior have you seen that you thought never existed that really surprised you?
That's a good question. And I'm sure I just need a little time to think about it.
Oh, no problem. Yeah. I was just curious because I imagine a herd of lambs. I've never heard of a herd of lambs. So that's why the question came to mind.
Yeah. It's a flock. Actually, it's a flock of lambs. The lambs we just got in this year, they're not adapted to our environment or our land and landscape yet. So what we're looking forward to is these lambs that we got in, the ewe lambs, they had babies this year. And we think that the next year's offspring will be so much more adapted to our environment. Just talk about animal behavior, just adapting to individual farms environment is really critical, to see animals do well. But, the other thing that we really focus on, Rich, is we really focus on building trusting relationships with consumers. I mean, we feel like we feel really called to do that. And that's just a big focus of what our operation is. It's reaching out to the community and being transparent to our customers. And, we understand that when customers buy from our farm and they buy the Seven Sons brand, the reason they're buying from us is because they lost trust in where they're buying food before. And so we take that trust really serious. It's just kind of core to our belief systems and who we are. I mean, we feel like that when we exchange, when someone pays us for food and we exchange a dollar for the food products that we produce, we feel like we're directly responsible for that person's future health and well-being. And I think that's a belief that if every farmer took to heart, you would see an entirely different agriculture system. You would see, an entirely different, you would see emptier hospitals, just people wouldn't be as sick if farmers took on the heartfelt responsibility, knowing that they have so much impact over the health of a consumer and the health of a society. It's we're the managers of the soil, and it doesn't matter.
Do you guys eat all the stuff that you produce, or do you tend to say, this is our business, I don't have time, I'll just eat whatever?
Yeah, we eat, everything we produce, and we actually, it's important to us too that even our staff, we have a staff of about 40 employees, and part of their compensation packages is they get food credits in order to eat food from our farm. So that's important to us. It's who we are.
Okay. How much of a health difference have you noticed, let's say, as you or your various family members have committed to eating, mostly or entirely what you guys produce, if that's possible?
Yeah. Well, I think my mom is just a great example of someone that was able to really turn her health around, by being intentional about what she was eating. I feel like that when I eat our food, it's so much more nutrient dense. I don't feel like I have to eat as much of it to get full. And it makes sense. I mean, this is food, animals that are raised on nutrient dense, rich soils. It just makes sense that you're going to get a richer food product with more minerals and nutrients, in that food. So, we feel very healthy. We feel very blessed to be able to eat from our own farm. It's unique. And, we love just giving our customers the opportunity to partake in that, that nutrient dense harvest that we have, all throughout the year.
Okay. So do you run a CSA, or where does all the stuff you produce go to? Like what are you out with?
Yeah. Most of our food from our farm is sold online. So most customers are placing orders through our website. Roughly 85% of the food that leaves our farm is an e-commerce or an online order. So customers find us online, and we have about 10,000 active customers buy from us each year. And so we do everything through home delivery. So everything is shipped out in a insulated and cooled box to customers' doorsteps. So we'll make anywhere from 30 to 40,000 home deliveries every year. And that is our main partner on that is UPS. We actually use UPS to deliver the food to customers' doors. And it's kind of the ultimate for convenience for our customers. You know, and what we sell is a niche product. And so the internet is a great place to connect with, you know, those niche consumers that appreciate what we do and value what we do. So we're primarily internet-based. We also have a on-farm store. So right here on the farm, you can visit. It's open 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. And we always invite our customers, no matter where they're buying from us from, we always invite customers to come out to the farm and visit the store. In the summer, we do wagon tours, pretty in-depth wagon tours, where we take groups of folks, you know, on a 2-hour trek through the farm, and we stop and we show them a soil health demonstration. So we teach them what healthy soil looks like. And so it's a little bit of a on-farm workshop when we do those wagon tours. And then each year we also do what we call a farm festival, and we'll get anywhere from 1500 to 2,500 folks that come out to the farm on a single day. And it's more of a fun party on the farm. We have straw maize and food, live music, wagon tours, but it's a real fun event. Every fall we do that. So,
well, very cool. What area do you serve? You know, where do people have to live in order to get your products? Do you ship some of them nationwide, or is it just locally?
Yeah, for most of our business past, we've just been locally and regionally, which is still where most of our customers are. But today, if you get on our website, we can actually ship to nationwide at this point. So as our farm has grown, we've just been able to get set up better to ship our products further. But prior to 3 years ago, you would have had to, we're in Fort Wayne, Indiana, northern Indiana. For a while, we only delivered to the Indiana area, Chicago, you know, folks that were within a 3 to 4 hour radius of us. But now you can get it nationwide. And all the orders are packed up here at the farm, and we get them on a UPS truck several days a week, and everything's delivered that way now.
Well, very good. What's the best way for people to find out more about your products and your farm? Where can they go?
Yep, sevensons.net. That's the hub of everything. You can learn about our practices there. Another great place to search us would be on YouTube, Seven Sons Farms on YouTube. We have, I think, over 100 YouTube videos and several million views. There's a lot of great content on there, videos that show our customers exactly how we raise animals. And it's a great place to learn more about how we do that. And of course, we're on most of the social media platforms as well, sharing just, you know, content about our farm.
Excellent. Well, Blaine, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you, Rich. Appreciate the opportunity.
Before you stop listening, ask yourself, what are one or two useful things you heard on this podcast that can help you overcome food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation? Please like and subscribe and tell your friends and family about their Surviving Hard Times podcast. We're all going to need help now and in the near future.